just asked our departments to manage their budget as carefully and efficiently as they could to seek some additional savings in the current year.
The Palin administration explains their plan for budget savings. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 5th of February. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, making the most of the state weatherization program.
Some of the raiders have taken it on their own to work through us, to go out to places like Kotzebue, Haines, just anywhere.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
The Palin administration today began explaining the effects of the proposed cuts to the current year's budget. In her plan, more than $13 million in unspecified cuts will be left to the individual departments to find. Senate Finance Co-Chair Lyman Hoffman told Revenue Commissioner Pat Galvin that in making reductions on its own, the administration is taking the policymaking role away from lawmakers.
If we're going to set a policy, we need to know where they go instead of handing a blank negative check to you and you decide where you want cuts.
He said the budget the governor signed last year and currently in effect was a policy direction from the legislature. He said the governor could have vetoed the expenditures then, but cannot veto them a year later. Galvin assured Hoffman and the entire committee that no services will be reduced because of the cuts. He says the departments have known since the governor signed the plan last spring, and he has taken steps to meet that reduction throughout the year. That was before oil prices began to fall and the state's income began going down along with it. Deputy Commissioner Jerry Burnett said it has been considered a restriction in the budget since it was signed.
We took action and delayed hiring of positions as the commissioner and restricted that much money in the accounting system in the personal services line. And that savings has already occurred.
Hoffman says the public has an expectation of services, and the legislature's decision on those services should be binding. Galvin says the level of service has not been changed from the public's viewpoint. Management and Budget Director Karen Rehfeld says the governor first mentioned the anticipated cuts in the letter she sent lawmakers when she signed the plan, and the executive branch has been making and implementing plans since then. She believes legislative concern comes from the way the cuts were presented.
What we said early on is that it was never our intention to do this to impact services or to lay off employees or any of those kinds of things. We specifically said this isn't to cut services or positions. We just asked our departments to manage their budget as carefully and efficiently as they could to seek some additional savings in the current year.
Rehfeld said to address the concerns, she is preparing to send legislators the goals established by the departments and detailed reports on their progress. She said the governor is concerned with the size of the operating budget and will continue to try to control the growth of government. The U.S. Senate is set to work late into the night on the $900 billion economic stimulus package that's now on the floor. The Democratic Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada says he has enough votes for passage. But despite that claim, a bipartisan group is working behind the scenes to cut spending and come up with a compromise. They're trying to rein in some of the bill's expenses and refocus it on major infrastructure projects. Both of Alaska's senators have been involved in the closed-door meetings. Alaska Democrat Mark Begich says he's part of the gang trying to find compromises.
There's a lot of issues that people have. I mean, there's tons of amendments now occurring, and what people are starting to see is, well, are we going to get to an end here? I think at some point you do get to an end, but you still have to get 60 votes.
Begich says earlier today a group of about 20 senators comprised of roughly a dozen Democrats and six Republicans held two meetings. They were initiated by Nebraska Democrat Ben Nelson and with the cooperation of Republican Susan Collins of Maine. Even though they haven't yet released concrete specifics, aides say they may recommend cutting up to $100 billion from places like the National Science Foundation, education programs, and assistance to states. Begich says if the group does produce an amendment, it will include cuts.
you're going to see some reduction in that bill from this group. You will see some reduction. There's no question about it. And in the reduction, we also then see there's an opportunity to put something back in that's, you know, concrete, steel, mortar, pavement, you know, things that are putting people on the street and working immediately. And I think that's what we're focused on. But you'll see some reductions.
Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski attended a meeting of the group today but hasn't given them her support. Her office says she's listening. But Alaska is in the unique position of having both its senators willing to work on a compromise. Begich says today's meetings included at least 6 freshman Democrats, a big number for the group. Begich says they offer a uniquely bipartisan attitude. President Obama has encouraged Senate Democrats to make some compromises to get the bill passed. Begich heard that message today on his first visit to the White House as a U.S. senator. He, along with 9 other freshman Democrats, had lunch with the president's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel. Even as the White House gave freshman senators a message of compromise and urgency, one of the authors of the stimulus plan, Christina Romer, warned that it shouldn't be reduced too much. Romer chairs the president's Council of Economic Advisors.
It needs to be big precisely because the problems are big, and that when you just, you know, crunch the numbers, we definitely need a bold, aggressive recovery plan because we are facing really dire economic conditions.
Romer says there's not a lot of what she called silly stuff in the bill, and that its main goal is infrastructure development and putting Americans to work.
Where people are criticizing are often just, you know, a few million dollars here and there in a package this big. They're really just, a really very small fraction.
Majority Leader Harry Reid has now announced he plans to end legislating on the stimulus bill tonight. He plans to have Senate leaders return at 10 a.m. Friday to continue voting on amendments. Alaskans are making good use of the state's weatherization rebate program, and the results are beginning to show. The program was put together and is being managed by the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. CEO Dan Foskey says that while the program originally restricted who could participate, he is seeing incredible results since it was opened up to all Alaskans.
Well, now to go to this level of weatherization up to 100% immediate income, and if you're above that, we reinstated the rebate. So there are no income restrictions, and everyone's eligible. And so it's been pretty exciting, and the work's gone very well.
The results for the homeowners have been positive in ways that might not have been expected. John Anderson's weatherization officer says an average home has reduced its carbon dioxide emissions by 12,000 pounds per year. That average house has also seen a reduction in energy costs of more than $1,300 a year. Foskey says the program has worked its way out of some early problems. The agency has increased the number of trained people to do the initial ratings from 32 to 98. They centralized the application process, and they have found a way to get service to rural areas.
As areas have slowed or they've caught up with work, some of the raters have taken it on their own to work through us to go out to places like Kotzebue, Haines, just anywhere. They'll go out and help bring the load up. If we haven't been successful, for instance, in getting a raider trained to live in that particular locale, which we know is not going to happen in all places.
The program has had 5,600 people start the process by scheduling their initial energy rating. 329 have finished the energy conservation work on their homes and have already been issued their rebates. Brian Butcher with AHFC says they anticipate a big influx of completed projects in a few months.
We expect that number to really increase as we get into spring and summer and people have an opportunity to do a lot of the work that they wouldn't normally be doing in the wintertime. Since they do have an 18-month period from their first rating to get the job done, to get the work completed, the summer is when we really expect it to spike.
Foskey says AHFC has adequate funding to continue the program through next year. By then, he says, he hopes the plan will become a regular service of state government. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, lawmakers consider limits on alcohol for damp communities.
Since alcohol is the major contributor to violent crimes, and I'd say 90% of the crimes in Bush, Alaska.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
some rural residents could be restricted to a lot less alcohol per month if bills in Juneau pass the legislature. The bills deal with alcohol limits in Bethel, Kotzebue, and a few other damp communities in the state, communities that do not have liquor stores but are allowed to ship in a limited amount of alcohol. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
The language in the two bills is the same, but one is Senate Bill 85 and the other is House Bill 91. They're both requested by the governor through the Rules Committee. The bills would reduce the amount of distilled spirits allowed by 75% and wine and malt beverages by 50%. Currently in Bethel, residents can ship in 10.5 liters of hard liquor per month. The bills propose to reduce that limit to 3 liters. Likewise, residents could possess 16 bottles of wine per month, down from 32. The beer would be cut in half also, from 6 gallons down to 3 gallons, or what's a little more than 2.5 cases. Besides increasing alcohol limits, the bills would also increase penalties for bootleggers and those illegally selling alcohol to minors. Both Bethel area lawmakers, Senator Lyman Hoffman and Representative Bob Herron, say they would not support this bill as written if it came up for a vote today. Hoffman, who represents most of Southwest Alaska, says there are some good things behind the bill.
I think the thrust behind it, or the intentions, are good to try to alleviate alcohol abuse in rural areas of the state, since alcohol is the major contributor to violent crimes, and I'd say 90% of the crimes in Bush, Alaska.
However, he says putting more limits on the amount of booze residents can possess will not necessarily solve the problem. He says current monthly alcohol limits exist for a reason.
When people order alcohol, they order it in convenient sizes and in packages so they don't have to be broken apart. And that does not mean that that individual is going to consume that amount in the 30 days. On a monthly basis, I don't think that there's a need to change the quantities that individuals can order. They may order 2 or 3 times a year.
Representative Bob Herron agrees that parts of the bill seem okay, but he also does not agree with reducing the amount of alcohol that damp communities can get. He says his office has heard from some disgruntled residents.
Bethel has chosen to be a damp community since 1973. And sure, we've tweaked with the law and tweaked with local option, but the community has been doing this for a long time. And for someone outside our community, without talking to the legislators, without talking to the community, this is thrown on a damp community. And so a few people, understandably, are a little miffed by that.
The bills also propose to increase penalties for bootleggers. It would make first-time offenders of felony bootlegging do some prison time. In addition, the bills would also adopt a civil fine for a licensee whose employees sell to minors. Currently, the employees get charged with a Class A misdemeanor if they sell or serve alcohol to minors, but nothing happens to the business where the sale happened. The new bills would fine the business $1,000 if an employee sells to a minor for the second time. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Wrangell is looking to release remaining funds toward the Alaska-British Columbia intertie. The borough charged the Wrangell Energy Committee with coming up with a basic action plan to present at next week's Alaska Energy Authority meeting. Completion of the AKBC intertie could lead to more hydroelectric power in southeast Alaska. KSTK's Tony Gorman reports.
The plan consists of ways Wrangell will use $650,000 to complete the AKBC intertie. Assemblymember Ernie Christian is chairman of the Wrangell Energy Committee. He says the completion of the intertie could open up opportunities for the southeast region.
It spurs the economic development of maybe non-potentially feasible hydro projects become feasible because it has a market. And, of course, it helps Wrangell for economic stability and create new jobs throughout the region. And I think it's just a win-win situation for everybody concerned. And I think on the Canadian side, they're looking for renewable energy, too, and hopefully they'll build their side. And we're looking time frame-wise, everything has to kind of happen together to make it work. But we're taking the first step right now.
The proposal includes hiring an energy consultant firm, securing permits from the Lake Tahoe Hydro plant to the Canadian border, creating a timeline for construction, updating construction plans and costs, updating the feasibility study, and keeping in contact with British Columbia officials. Christian says he hopes Wrangell can get more funding once the permits are in place.
With a coalition between Alaska and British Columbia and the state and local level, we could lobby and hopefully get some of that money. The last construction cost for the intertie was in 2007 was between $26 and $28 million. Of course, prices have gone up, so we're hoping that maybe they can secure that funding from the state or federal level.
The Energy Committee will present the proposal at next week's assembly meeting. Then it will go before the AEA on Thursday, February 12th. Christian says he hopes the borough can convince the AEA that the proposal is a step in the right direction.
I think this is the best use of the money because that's what it originally was appropriated for. And I believe Wrangell can push the ball forward and with everybody's help. So hopefully we can produce the intertie and help everybody in our region.
Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Tony Gorman.
The field of applicants seeking to pursue a hydroelectric power plant in Thomas Bay, north of Petersburg, has grown. The city of Angoon has filed for preliminary federal permits for a hydro plant at Ruth Lake and Scenery Lake on the mainland, north of Petersburg. Both the city of Wrangell and the city of Petersburg also applied for a Federal Energy Regulatory Commission preliminary permit for Ruth Lake this week. In addition, Cascade Creek, a private Bellingham, Washington company, also filed an application for Ruth Lake. Cascade Creek has held that preliminary permit for the past 3 years, but it expired this month. J. Mark Robinson is the director of the Office of Energy Projects with the Federal Commission in Washington, D.C. He points out that a preliminary FERC permit does not authorize any construction on a project.
The only thing a preliminary permit does is to give someone here at the commission a place in line, a priority for the filing of an application that if it's approved by the commission would allow for the construction of a project. So it's nothing more than just a, like when you go in to get a cup of coffee and you get the number off the wall to let them know who's going to be served up. That's what a preliminary permit does for you. It doesn't authorize any land disturbing activity. Having said that, when we do get into these situations where there are competing preliminary permits, we have some long established criteria that come into play.
Robinson says the commission gives a preference to a municipality over a private company and will also consider which application is filed first.
So the first thing you would look at would be, of course, municipal preference, and then you have to go in and look at first in time. And we just have received these applications, all came in, I believe, yesterday. So we'll, you know, be checking through them, making sure everything is the way it's supposed to be. And then ultimately what we'll do, we'll notice these applications. We'll put them out for a, in about 30 days, we'll notice them. We'll put them out for a 60-day notice period, at which times other people can come in and compete for that preliminary permit if they so choose. Once that notice period has ended and we have the full record in front of us, then the commission will review it, see what criteria apply, and award the preliminary permit to the person that should receive it.
A member of the law firm that submitted the filing on Petersburg's behalf emailed to the city that Petersburg and Wrangell both filed applications at 8:30 in the morning Tuesday, and he thinks the two applications will compete on their merits. Above and beyond the preliminary permit, a municipality or company will need a federal license to do the actual construction of any power plant or transmission line in Thomas Bay. The Federal Commission's Robinson says a license application has a higher priority.
That application, if it comes in, trumps all preliminary permit applications, either municipality or private. And here, where you have work that has been being done, there's always the possibility that someone may file that notice, and then they have 120 days after they have made that that intent known to actually file the application. And if the application is found to satisfy the commission regulations, it trumps all permit applications, and we start the licensing process.
Cascade Creek also holds a preliminary permit for Swan Lake, a third potential hydro site in Thomas Bay. All the applications would mean a dam on the high mountain lakes and a tunnel or penstock used to drop water down to turbines near sea level. Angoon's application says it would sell the power to Petersburg, Wrangell, and Ketchikan through existing or soon-to-be-completed transmission lines. Angoon also hopes to use the hydropower once a larger regional power grid is completed. Cascade Creek's application says it would sell the power first to southeast communities and later to customers in Canada or the lower 48 through a transmission line up the Bradfield Canal into British Columbia. Petersburg and Wrangell also want the electricity for local use. Wrangell is working with the private company Cascade Creek and is also interested in exporting the power to out-of-state customers. The mayor of Angoon was traveling and not available for comment on the community's interest in the project. The state has accepted a petition from the city of Fairbanks to annex acreage on the west side of town. City Mayor Terry Sturl says the local boundary commission is moving forward on the proposal to absorb residential and commercial lots, including one occupied by a Fred Meyer store.
The public has until April 17th to make comments on our annexation petition. Then after that, the LBC will have an opportunity to respond to those comments, and then the LBC will hold a hearing here in our community.
The city plan is to take in the lots which occupy an area formerly at the edge of town that has developed over the decades. Mayor Sturl says the annexation is aimed at cleaning up what now appears to be an arbitrary line between adjacent properties and drawing property tax money from landowners that already rely on some city services.
They don't receive police or fire protection, but they benefit, again, from city services because their streets are plowed and their streets are maintained, yet they're not in the city. And I understand that that's from years and years ago, and it was kind of based on utilities, if people decided they wanted utilities or not. So it's really kind of, in our view, just cleaning up a little bit of an area that should be in the city.
Sturl says the city police and fire departments can handle picking up service for the properties, including the big Fred Meyer store. Fred Meyer spokeswoman Melinda Merrill in Portland, Oregon, says the annexation proposal has put the company in a difficult situation.
I appreciate what the city is trying to do and how they're trying to shore up their funding, and I understand where they're coming from. But we've got to take a look at it from a standpoint of safety in our stores for our employees and for our customers. So what kind of change can we expect in the level of services, if any? And we've got to take a look at the cost implications. And we're doing that right now. So haven't taken a position at this point, but we'll absolutely need to do so in the near future.
Merrill says talks are ongoing with the local Fred Meyer store director and Fairbanks city officials before taking an official stance on the annexation proposal. Mayor Sturl had proposed delaying the annexation effort in anticipation of a city sales tax vote next fall that could complicate the situation, but the city council didn't agree and moved ahead with the plan.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Public Radio Network promotes Alaska's cultures, regions, and ethnic diversity, including a commitment to informing and empowering Alaska's Native peoples.
Records show the ferry Lituya lost 2,000 gallons of fuel when it went aground near Metlakatla last month. A smaller sheen was spotted by environmental and recovery staff, but a later check of logs and tank soundings showed the larger amount missing. The Coast Guard says the fuel could have spilled through a vent when the ship listed. It says high winds and rough weather could have caused the diesel to dissipate quickly. State spokesman Roger Weatherall says people at the scene did not see or smell that much fuel. He says another possibility is a paperwork error.
We are conducting an internal investigation to ensure that our record keeping is up to par. If not, we'll have to look at other possible angles as to what might have happened to the fuel. And we're looking at the possibility of some sort of problem that arose with managing the amount of fuel that was in there, knowing what was there.
The ferry grounded on Scrub Island after high winds broke it free from the Metlakatla ferry terminal. No one was on board at the time. Ferry officials are also looking into why the ship came loose. The grounding left a hole in the Lituya's hull and damage to cooling equipment. Weatherall says repairs will begin soon.
Well, the Lituya right now remains in Ketchikan at the Alaska Ship and Dry Dock facility. We intend to put it up on the dry dock blocks this weekend alongside the fair weather and begin addressing some of the mechanical repairs that are going to be necessary.
The Lituya sailed from Metlakatla to Ketchikan 5 days a week. The Stikine, owned by the Inter-Island Ferry Authority, is covering the route until repairs are completed. Weatherall says the Lituya should be back in service by the end of February. Prices for petroleum products are down, but charges from businesses that use them seem to remain up. It's certainly the case in the airline industry, including Alaska Airlines' baggage fees. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the story.
Back in July, Alaska Airlines started charging for the second or more bag on out-of-state flights. They added a $25 fee, $100 for the third piece, following a nationwide air industry trend. At the time, Alaska Airlines official Steve Jarvis said it was part of coping with higher fuel costs.
It's one of our ways to try to have those customers that are going to burn more fuel pay more for the fuel.
Now those costs have lowered, but the baggage fees remain. And with a slower economy and reduced ridership, there does not appear to be any chance they'll go away. Paul McElroy is a spokesman for the airline.
It's true that oil prices drove us to that decision initially, but what we found is that customers are very price sensitive in terms of what they are willing to pay for a ticket. And we and other airlines have found that this a la carte pricing is a good way to charge customers for the services that they are receiving.
A la carte means paying separately. Critics say extra for meals, bags, and so on. Alaska Airlines is not a holdout in this area. Carriers around the nation are keeping their fees intact, and some even charge for the first piece of luggage. That's upset some travelers, but Michael Cintron of the International Airline Passengers Association says it's not going to change.
The baggage fees, I do not think, are going away. Despite the drop in oil prices, the airlines seem to be gearing up for that next wave of price spikes, either oil or some other part of their operating costs.
And those costs are high. Alaska Airlines lost $75 million in the last 3 months of 2008. That's a big change from the $7.5 million in net earnings for the same months of the previous year. Cintron says at least the airline hasn't tried to hide the reason for its ticket hikes.
Some airlines imposed these fuel surcharges on their airfares, and when the oil prices started tumbling back down to earth, they publicly announced that they would eliminate them. But in many cases, they just simply shifted the base fare of their ticket and said they eliminated the surcharge. So it's kind of a little shell game that they sometimes play.
Alaska Airlines is somewhat unusual in that it allows three free bags for in-state flights. The Seattle-based business says that's because it understands its key role in transporting basic goods. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tony Gorman in Wrangell, Joe Vicknicki in Petersburg, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is our vice president for media production. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.